Well, good afternoon. I've been here for a while. It's nice to see everyone. Shelby is under the weather still. A couple of weeks ago, she got something. I guess it's that bronchitis kind of thing that starts here and goes on down. And she hasn't been able to shake it. She'll have a good day on occasion. Yesterday, she said she felt kind of human and got dressed and everything. And then this morning, she's sick again. So it's been off and on for about 2 weeks, so she misses everybody and says hello. I found out, we got a letter from Legacy yesterday, and I found out that I'm going to Thailand for sure. It hadn't really been decided, I didn't think, for sure, but my name's in there as having, as going for the feast, so I'm looking forward to that. The reason it wasn't for sure is that I didn't know that Leon had arranged his trip to Burma. He and Gloria were wanting to go to Burma, and I believe that, I guess they worked that out or are in the process of working it out, because he's already announcing that he's going, that I will be going to Thailand to serve the members there while they are in Burma. So it'll be for the entire Feast of Unleavened Bread. I'll go for about 2 weeks. I'll leave to get there in time for Passover and then come back. Let's see, the last day of Unleavened Bread I think is on like a Friday, so I'll come back on Monday. And so I'm looking forward to that, going and seeing some of the people that I already know and some new people. They hope to get at least one, if not more, families from the border camps to be able to come to Chiang Mai. And the plan in Burma, I've told some of you this already, but the plan is to go to a town, and I don't remember the name of the town, somewhere toward the center that's easy to get to, and have the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread there, and then all the members who can and who want to in Burma come to that town. And none of them have any money, so basically that's a big project, and Legacy has to pay for them all to get there, which is, Leon estimated the expenses for that, the Burmese side of the trip, at about $10,000. That's what he told me privately. So that's a need they have for the Feast of Unleavened Bread and for Passover. I don't think I've updated you all on the orphanage that my friend Lalian is in the process of building. And for a while there, he wasn't doing a whole lot. He's had some setbacks. He had a sister that had to go in the hospital. And when that happens, you don't, you know, you're working for her sake and paying off bills and so forth. You're not working on something else. And then he's got had a brother who was in a motorcycle accident, same kind of problem. But I did get some pictures, and those of you that are, I'll probably share them with all of you, but those that have contributed, I will share some pictures. And there is a building up. It's two stories, and it, you know, the main structure of it is up, although it didn't have the sheathing on the side nor on the roof, I don't think, at the time. But there's something there. His original plan was to be done in 2012. I don't know if he'll make it or not. It seems that he gets a lot done when he has the time and the energy and the ability to devote time to it. I think he kind of runs the farm for his family, so he probably gets their help as well. But then when it's time to put the rice in, you got to drop everything and put the rice in. When it's time to harvest the rice, you got to drop everything and do that too. So you know, there are times of the year when he's busy and can't do anymore. I haven't broached the subject with him or with Leon yet, but there might be an opportunity. I've only ever given him money when he first went and got started. So we may be able to get some more money to him, since Leon will be in Burma. And it's just not, it hasn't been altogether safe just to send money to Burma, because there's a good chance the police will get quite a bit of it. So typically you like to have it in somebody's hand to take with. Even then, they kind of know you have it, and they try to get some, shake you down a little. But so it may be possible to give Lalian another installment to help him finish via Leon somehow. Well, I haven't worked on that yet, but I will. All right, I told you before, I think, that I plan to have a series of sermons. It may be three sermons. And I want to give you an overall approach for what I'm going to do. And I'm going to try to make it interesting by maybe combining certain things. But the general concept will be learning a bit about some other religions, some other belief systems. You and I, probably, if you're anything like me, you tend to have been raised with the approach that you're right and everybody else is wrong. That's kind of the way we do things religiously in the American evangelical side of things. And there's plenty of the rest of the world that's the same way, although sometimes not so bad as we are. And I think it would be good, perhaps, to understand a little bit about how the rest of the world is. Whether we consider them right or wrong is not necessarily my issue. But I thought about this also from the standpoint that we have always entertained the thought that we will in some manner or another be involved in teaching these people. That when God sets his hand to call the nations, to call everybody, and to open their minds to his truth, that most everybody is going to be coming, maybe it's fair to say everybody is going to be coming from a perspective that is not correct, including us. We don't know everything either. So I think, is helpful to have a certain understanding of where other people are coming from, especially when it's a sizable portion of the rest of the world. What I'm going to do, though, is we'll investigate some other belief systems, and when we do that, we will compare and contrast them to what we believe, and I think that will be instructive. It certainly has been for me. And in the process, I expect that you, like me, will be become more appreciative for the revelation that God has given us in this book right here. This is significant. What's in here is very significant. And I hope by the end of this series that it will be more significant to you. Also, because the timing is that, you know, Passover is coming up. We're going to have a new moon here in a day or two or three or whatever. It was hardly a sliver this morning when it came up. That means we're a month and a half or so to Passover. So what I want to do is, as we go through this, is I want to also, when we do the compare and contrast, is I'm going to make it applicable to some of the thinking and the processing of ideas that we do prior to Passover. So I'm going to connect all that. The goal is to connect all that together. So the outline for the three sermons, if I can do it in three, and I don't know, sometimes I think I've already bitten off more than I can chew, but what we want to do today is look at some ancient beliefs and practices in a general overview and contrast that with what we believe from Scripture and show how Scripture is something unique and different there. The next time that I speak in a few weeks, I plan to go into some religions that are still on the scene today, primarily Hinduism and Buddhism. Buddhism that I have some familiarity with, from having been to Asia. Hinduism, which I'll just learn about. And those two religions represent quite a chunk of the human race today. So I think that's worthwhile going into. And we will compare what they believe, and specifically what they believe about the future and the reward of the saved, if you want to call it that, as we use it in Christian terms, what you get from their perspective and their worldview as compared to the Christian worldview. And they're so appreciably different. And that should be inspiring, I hope. And also the path that it takes to get there. On the last sermon, if I can do it all in one, and this is one I'm not so sure, I'll cover the religion of the Bible, the Old Testament in particular, and then how it diverged into Christianity and Judaism, and then later on Islam becomes an added factor to give you two more major religions of our time, Christianity and Islam. And also then that'll be right before Passover, so if I can cover all that, I'll do it. If not, I'll cover part of that and then tie it in with some of the significance of Passover. So that's my plan. I just want to share that with you so you know where we're going. And overall, the idea is to step back and to get a big picture. Now, some of you may appreciate that. Some of you may not. I apologize to those that it doesn't do anything for. But sometimes I think it's good to step back. We can sit around and say, well, is it this calendar? Is it that calendar? Is it this day? Is it that day? Is it this? You know, Passover is on this part of this day, and you know, we can in the Christian world, we have a history of disputing about a whole lot of things that maybe are not that important, if I can put it that way. But what I hope to do, and I've done this a little bit in times past. I spoke about creation stories, creation myths, maybe 4 years ago. I've also spoken about my trips to Thailand. And in both of those cases, I tried to paint a big picture for you to show you that what you believe is way different than what other people believe. And it's so very, very different that some of the particulars that sometimes we get in, you know, heated discussions, maybe not in this congregation, but in the Christian world, there are all kinds of heated discussions about all kinds of things. And they seem important to us, but in when you step back and get a really big picture, they're not as important. At least I will make that claim. You can decide for yourself. I'll try to paint the bigger picture and help you. Let's have a little fun with the board here and talk about the world in general and the people in the world. All right. That's a pie chart with no lines on it yet. Let's say, for instance, I want to put some lines on there. I want to break people down into some categories, okay? Can you think of some categories? Maybe even, Lee, can you think of a category? What about people? How are people different? Maybe there's different kinds of people. Some of them are like you, some of them are like your brothers. What's that? Boys and girls. Now, if I wanted to draw a line on this chart as to which ones, how many boys we have and how many girls, what kind of a line would I put on there, Justin? How would I split this up? If I'm going to have boys on one side and girls on one side, do I draw a line like this? No, how would I draw the line? Top to the bottom. I draw a diameter. Because 50%, half the people on earth are boys and half the people on earth are girls. So that's a simple and a good way to break down the, I should have got the wireless mic. I didn't think about that. I'm going to move around, but I'll shout to my sound man here. That's one way to break down people, boys and girls, okay? Now, there's other ways we can break it down, too. I got a list here of certain things. For instance, let's say we wanted to break it down for adults and children. What do you think? And what percentage of the world are adults? Any guesses? Come on, be brave. More than half? Yeah, it is. It is, let's see. 66%? That would be adults, but then you have more adults, this is the children over here. Children, adults, and seniors. Seniors in a separate category, actually a little bit bigger than that. So yeah, most of the world's adults. If you count, I think they counted 26% would be children. What if we wanted to divide the world up by where the people live? Think about that. Sometimes we get very North American centric, American centric, whatever.
Asia.
60% of the world is Asian. You heard that old joke about every fourth person is Chinese or something like that. So why you only want to have six? I only want to have three kids. That's the way it works. 15% American. 15% African. See if I get the rest here. 11% Europeans. I'm leaving somebody out, or I'm not drawing my lines right. I didn't draw all that right. My 60's right, I'm big enough. But anyway, the point I was trying to make, main point here, is that Asia's most of the world. More than half of the people in the world are Asian. And a large chunk of them are Chinese. And another large chunk of them are Indian. Because of languages, 12% of the world speaks some form of Chinese. Only 5% speak English. All right. Now here's what, and we could draw some other lines on there if you want. If you had 100 people, one of them is dying of starvation. Just paint a big picture here. One of them is dying of starvation. 15 would be undernourished. 21 of them would be overweight. 7 would have a college degree out of 100. 77% of the people would have a place where they're sheltered from the weather. 23% wouldn't. 87% would have safe drinking water. That's good. I wouldn't have thought it was that high. But 13% of the people wouldn't have safe drinking water. This is an amazing thing. If I draw that line straight down and maybe come off a little bit, 48% of the world live on $2 a day. When you think about the world, think about these things. I'm just drawing a big picture with a diagram before I draw another diagram. And this is the one where I'm going to draw the religions.
What's the largest religion in the world?
Christianity.
It's roughly
33%.
Now, it's people who claim to be Christian. Roughly 33% Christian. Second biggest religion in the world?
Islam.
By the way, 33% and going down. The second biggest religion is Islam, about 21%. This is Christianity, this is Islam. Islam, going down or going up?
Up.
The third biggest chunk of religious people, religious categories would be none. People that actually claim not to have any. And that's roughly the same size as the chunk that's Hindu. Again, I'm not drawing this too awful well. There should be more space than this left. But what you got left is Buddhism's a big one. And you got another big chunk, fairly big chunk, it's just Chinese traditional local religions. And then you got some slivers. You got a bunch of slivers. One of which is Judaism. One of which is, I've got to look it up. Oh, Sikhism. But, you know, Judaism doesn't even make the map. Doesn't even make the diagram. Christianity is the largest by far. But then Christianity has, you know, how many subcategories? So that's one way, that's another way of breaking down the world in a big picture. So in the three-sermon plan, you want to put it that way? I'm going to talk about ancient religions, which aren't on here at all. Well, why do I want to talk about ancient religions? Any guesses? Waste your time?
That's where a lot of them are derived from.
I'm sorry? That's right. That's the reason. I was going to start with Hinduism and Buddhism as some of the oldest religions that are on the face of the earth right now that are different than us. But I realized I had to go to ancient religions because that's what was the beginning. That's what the atmosphere was. All the other religions came out of that atmosphere, either as part of it or opposed to it or whatever. They all came from that environment. So ancient religions in the first one. Second one, we're just going to talk about this chunk here. And then the third one, I'm going to try to talk about all of this right here. Christianity, Islam, Judaism. We'll see if it works. But that's the plan anyway. Our story, what we believe, as well as many other stories, as Gary pointed out, began in an environment of what I'm going to term ancient religion. You can call it what you want. We're going to call it ancient religion. I'm going to read some things first. I beg your indulgence here as I do some reading. Let me read a little bit about ancient Mesopotamian religion, just to give you a flavor. I'm going to specifically read from what they call mythology. This is just an overview, a summary from Wikipedia. There are no specific written records explaining Mesopotamian religious cosmology. Well, Mesopotamia. Where's Mesopotamia? What do we know about that? Why would I be talking about Mesopotamia? Why does it matter?
Iraq.
Iraq. Hugh?
A lot of the stuff that originated there is still alive today.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff started there. Where is it? Iraq. It's over there where the Tigris and Euphrates come down to the come down to the sea there. So, I'll continue reading here. Nonetheless, modern scholars have examined various accounts and created what is believed to be at least a partially accurate description of Mesopotamian cosmology. In other words, it's not just one book that explains everything. Like, if you wanted to understand something about Judaism, you'd look at the Old Testament here. If you wanted to understand something about Christianity, you have a book. It's not that way for these religions. But there are different accounts of different events that pieced together can give a fuller view of what the religion was like. For instance, the Epic of Creation, where it explains that the god Marduk killed the mother goddess Tiamat and used half her body to create the earth, and the other half to create both the paradise of Samu and the netherworld of Irsutu.
A document from a similar period stated that the universe was a spheroid with three levels of Samu in which the gods dwelt and where the stars existed above the three levels of Earth below it. So this is, these ideas from reading what texts do exist. Representation of the goddess Ishtar, you've heard of her, winged and wearing a version of the horned cap of divinity. There's a picture of her here. That was just the caption of the picture. Mesopotamian religion was polytheistic. Okay, that's very important. Polytheistic, more than one god. Thereby accepting the existence of many different deities, both male and female. That's important. Though it was also henotheistic, that's with certain gods being viewed as superior to others by their specific devotees. These devotees were often from a particular city or city-state that held this deity as its patron deity. For instance, the god Enki was often associated with the city of Eridu, and the god Marduk was associated with Babylon. While the full number of gods and goddesses found in Mesopotamia is not known, this one German researcher in 1938 counted around 2,400 that we now know about, most of which had Sumerian names. In the Sumerian languages, the gods were referred to as Dingar. In the Akkadian language, they were known as Ilu, and these are not important. There seems to be a syncretism between those two groups, and you'll find that, of course, in religion. There were numerous gods. The Mesopotamian gods bore many similarities with humans and were anthropomorphic, thereby having humanoid form. Similarly, they acted often like humans, requiring food and drink, as well as drinking alcohol and subsequently suffering the effects of drunkenness. In many cases, the various deities were family relations of one another, a trait found in many polytheistic religions. Okay, I just want to give you a flavor there. You probably have read similar accounts, and you know some things about the religions from Mesopotamia. I have all kinds of information about religion in Egypt, too. And what you have, both in Babylon and in Egypt, but to a greater extent in Egypt, we have records of what happened when the ancient religion became structured and organized, and you had a cult, and you had a temple, you had priests, and you had all this organized religion. It was what we just read from the Babylon area. It was just what we read, only it became more formal. And I won't go into that. I'll just read. This is I covered this in a sermon 4 years ago, but I brought the notes, and I just wanted to read a little bit about the creation story. And I made the point 4 years ago, and I'll make it again today, that, you know, again, we can talk and discuss, and in the Christian world we do, all kinds of details about what does Genesis 1 mean, what does Genesis 2 mean, what does Genesis 3 mean, how are we supposed to read that. But however it is you read it, it is way, way, way different than the other creation accounts. And that was the purpose of that sermon 4 years ago, to point that out, but I just want to review a little bit just to refresh your memory if you were here. Here's a tablet from the Enuma Elish, which is one of the creation stories. This is a translation of what was written there. I'll just read a few lines. When on high heaven was not named and the earth beneath did not yet bear a name, the primeval Apsu, who begat them, and Chaos, and Tiamat, the mother of them both. Their waters were mingled together, and no field was formed, so no marsh was to be seen. When of the gods, none had been called into being. So this is an account of how things came to be. In most societies that we have records of that had writing, and they had writing. In fact, people would say that writing was invented or, you know, just began in that area. Where we have writing, we have accounts of how things came to be. This is continuing from that account. The epic names, now this is where a discussion, I'm not quoting anymore. The epic names, three primeval gods, Apsu, the fresh water, Tiamat, the salt water, and their son Mumu, apparently the mist. Several other gods are created, Ea and his brothers, who reside in Tiamat's vast body. They make so much noise, it annoys Tiamat and Apsu greatly. Apsu wishes to kill the young gods, but Tiamat disagrees. So you got these very human characteristics, right? You got this, all this struggling and fighting going on. And arguing, and typical, this is called anthropomorphism, where the gods act like people. Okay? The vizier, Mumu, agrees with Apsu's plan to destroy them. Tiamat, to stop this from occurring, tells Ea that the time the most powerful of the gods, this is another thing about, I'm interrupting myself, but you read these accounts, and who is most powerful doesn't stay the same. It varies depending on the politics, depending on the situations, the circumstances. This person gets the up, this God gets the upper hand. Later on, this God gets the upper hand. It just depends. And that's typical. Typically, you study even Egyptian religion from time to time. Ea then becomes the chief god, and along with his consort, Damkina. Everybody understand consort? That's another consistent feature of these religions, is that the male gods that are at the near the top of the pantheon, especially the one who is at the top, always has a female consort, or almost always. That's typical, okay? Now, pointing these things out, because you read this book, it's very different. Very, very different. Okay, continuing. Marduk. Damkina has a son, Marduk, greater still than himself. Marduk is given the wind to play with, and with that he uses it to make dust storms and tornadoes. This disrupts Tiamat's great body and causes the god still residing in her to be unable to sleep. This is a problem. See, obviously, even the Babylonians didn't take this literally. They couldn't have. I can't imagine they took it literally, but this was their story. This is how they explained what happened. They persuade Tiamat to take revenge for the death of her husband. Her power grows, and some of the gods join her. So you get politics. You get, you know. She creates 11 monsters to help her win the battle and elevates Kingu, her new husband, to supreme dominion. Now, I don't know how supreme that dominion is if it takes your consort to elevate you to that position. How, you know, we joke about that, don't we? So you're in charge as long, you know. How does that work? I mean, she makes him in charge, but he... so anyway, Tiamat gets killed eventually, and the world is formed from her corpse. The subsequent 100 lines or so constitute the lost section of Tablet 5. The gods who sided with Tiamat are initially forced to labor in the service of the other gods. This is another thing that when you read through some of these stories, maybe not every one, but many of the stories, the gods are serving each other, and humans, to even a greater extent, are there for the pleasure of the gods and to serve their needs. They have needs. Gods have needs. That's different. And this, I was going to wait to point these things out, but you know, the god of this book doesn't have a need that we can fill, other than, I guess we can argue this point, does he have a need for fellowship? He wants to fellowship with us, to share himself with us. Is that a need? I don't know, maybe that's the wrong word, but he wants to do that because he loves us. But it's not a need, some kind of a need as in terms of his existence. He doesn't need us to exist. Finally, the gods confer kingship on Marduk, hailing him with 50 names. Most noteworthy is Marduk's symbolic elevation over Enlil, who was seen by earlier Mesopotamian civilizations as the king of the gods. So if it sounds confusing to you, yeah, it's confusing. It sounds confusing to me too. But it's typical. These are the kinds of stories that you have. They're nothing at all like Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Not even anything at all like Genesis 1 to 11. Okay? So we ought to appreciate what it is we have. I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying more so. Why would I bother reading creation stories from this area of the world? We already had a couple comments. I'm looking for another answer that nobody's given yet. Why would it matter what they fought in Mesopotamia? Why would that matter for those of us that are Christians? That's where Abraham was from. That was his background. That matters. In fact, you will find, and I'm going to turn to some places to show you, it influenced this book a lot. Now, does that mean that this book is representing those values? No, I don't mean that. But the people who wrote this book lived in those kinds of environments. And they had those kinds of sensitivities, and they were aware of these other worldviews. And sometimes it even influenced, I would suggest it even influenced their worldview a little bit, because they're products of their world, just like we are. In Genesis 11:28, don't turn there, that's where it says that God called Abraham, called Abram, you know, his family had already moved to Haran, I believe, and then God says, look, we want you to come down, you know, you're going to go where a place I showed you. But if you would turn to Acts chapter 7, where Stephen talks about it, Acts chapter 7, and I'll start in verse 2. Stephen said, men, brethren, and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia. I'm reading from the King James, is what I have with me here. Before he dwelt in Charan.
And he said to him, go, get you out of your country and from your kindred and come into the land which I will show you. And then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Charan. And from there he went, when his father was dead, he removed to this land where you now dwell. In other words, that's when, after his father died, he moved all the way into Canaan. So, Stephen says that's where Abraham came from. That's where his people were from. That's where his father was from. And in the book of Joshua, we have some more detail, which shouldn't be surprising. Joshua 24, I think it is. Yes, Joshua 24. And verse 2. Now, I hope that not only am I going to point, we're talking about the way the rest of the world thinks, but I want to show you how this affected, at least to a certain extent, how it affected people that we know of in the Bible, and how it affected their worldview, and what a difference it was. And at least once, and maybe more than once, I'm going to show you a verse that I never had a clue what it was talking about, and now I think I do, and it has to do with this sermon. So sometimes something's written in there, it's like, what does that mean? But you'll get a perspective today that I can't say none of you have ever understood it before, but I know I didn't. I didn't have a clue. So I'll share that with you a little later on. Joshua 24, verse 2 says that Joshua said to the people, thus says the eternal God of Israel, Yahweh, Elohim, I guess that's probably, you, and Yahweh's important. That was a name. This is a personal God who had a name, okay? He wasn't Lord in a general sense. I mean, he is Lord, but he's not, Baal was the word that they used for Lord, typically. Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time. We generally interpret that to mean the other side of the Euphrates. But even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. So here it's saying, look, they, not only did they live up there in the middle of that, but they were part of the society. That's who they worshipped. They worshipped all the gods just like everybody else did. They weren't different. They weren't called out yet. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood and led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and he multiplied, and his seed I gave to him. Okay, I don't need to read any more there. But the point is that in this book here, in Joshua, it explains not only did they live there, but they were part of it. They were part of the society. And God called Abram out of that. We'll come back to that. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But if I don't come back to that, make sure I remind me when we get around to the end. Okay, if you don't mind, I read a little bit to you. And you've got your own familiarity and experience. Let's put down some characteristics of the religion of Terah, Abraham's father. Maybe, probably Abraham's religion too. Well, the religion of that area or of other parts of the world, and we'll find out, the religion of Canaan. Let's put down some characteristics of what it was like or what their gods were like. I want to make a list. Anthropomorphic. That was first on my list too. Everybody understand that? Whoops, if I can spell it. Anthropomorphic. I should have Jim Johns here. Yeah, having to do with being human. You give the gods human characteristics. That's anthropomorphic. All right, they're like us. Now, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, he's like us too in some ways. So it's not, everything we put on this list isn't necessarily wrong. It depends on the extent you take it to and so forth. All right, anything else? What else was, give me another thing about their gods or about their religion. That's typical.
Polytheistic.
Many gods. That was second on my list. You looking at my notes?
Great minds.
Oh, thanks. Well, but these are the two things that didn't really pop out at you. There were many of them. Many gods. Now, some of the things I have on my list might be anthropomorphic is a huge category, and maybe we need to break it down into some other points. Okay, any other characteristics? What do you think?
They're always fighting among each other.
Okay, that's part of being anthropomorphic. They had conflict, just like humans do. Good. Always fighting among themselves. That's typical of the stories. Yes.
There were gods that controlled like rain and fire and that sort of thing.
Okay. What's a good way to phrase that?
Nature gods.
Okay. I had it here, but I didn't have a good way to put it. I would tie in with that, if I may. There are nature gods, and in that world, in that society, those societies, you use the gods to explain what?
Natural occurrences.
Or I'm going to put it this way. Explain the unexplainable. Is that fair?
Yes.
If you don't have a reason, if you don't know why, put a god in charge. That's not necessarily wrong. We do the same thing. If we get, you know, if it's a miracle, we say God did it. So I'm not, like I said, I'm not saying everything that's on this list is bad, but we're trying to characterize the ancient world, the religions of the ancient world. Any other things? And this could be part of being anthropomorphic too. Any other characteristics?
Male and female gods.
Male and female. Yeah. They have, okay. All right. Conflict. Sex. You could take that word either way. They were male and female, and they did what males and females do. They were anthropomorphic. They had children. All right. Anything else?
They were limited.
Limited.
Not omnipotent. Usually they were limited to a geographic region or a specific realm, such as the god of rain.
Okay.
Rivers, god of rain.
All right. I'll do this, and I'll do this. Because I have another thing on my list, and that is they're local. Typically, not always, most of them are local to one extent or another. Is that fair?
Yes.
And when we talk in a little while about Buddhism and Hinduism, it's, you know, it's still the same way. If a politician wants to win an election in Thailand, and it's important to get the district of Chiang, the province of Chiang Mai, he's going to go to that temple and make sure he puts in an appearance. And gives his offering or whatever. Why? Because there are local gods that have the local power, and you have to appease the local gods if you want to have success in their territory. It's still that way today. And it was definitely that way, and I'll show you right from Scripture, that it was that way in the ancient world. Okay, anything else? So they're limited because they were either confined to a particular, confined is a bad word, but associated with a certain natural phenomenon, like the weather, or the crops, or fertility, or you know, any number of things. Thunder, lightning, the unexplainable. We don't know why there's thunder and lightning. You know, there are pictures of Baal, the god of Canaan, the typical god of Canaan, holding a thunderbolt. You know, because they don't understand. So give it. You know, he's the one with the power. That seems very powerful. And not only are they associated with parts of Asia, but they tend to be local, tend to be associated with a particular city or a particular area. Okay, anything else? Oh, I'm sorry, Mike.
They made idols to represent them. I mean, they had figures that...
Okay, that would actually tie in with limited as well. They were, can I say, representable?
Yeah.
You could somehow or another make a picture or a carving or whatever that represented them. I didn't have that on my list. That's a good one. How did you approach these gods? What were they good for?
You could curry their favor with offerings or magic spells.
Okay. You would go to one of these. You would somehow try to appease the gods in order to curry favor. You needed them for... You needed them for immediate needed for immediate things, like food, water, whatever. That's a very poor way of putting it, but. And actually, that's not wrong. We say we need God too. But they would go to, you know, somehow or another offer to their gods to whatever it was they did, because they needed what? They needed rain for the crops, and they needed whatever. Anything else? I would add, there's probably a better way to put this, but appease or suffer consequences. In other words, do you know, make them happy or you will suffer. And you see a lot of that in our own scriptures, at least allusions to it.
Some of the gods could be killed.
Hmm?
Some of the gods could be killed.
They were mortal.
Mm-hmm.
So their limit, they could be mortal. In some cases. Some cases, metaphorically, they lived on even when their bodies were cut in half. It's weird, you know. There are metaphors there.
Vain and self-important.
I'm sorry?
Vain and self-important.
Okay, back to the anthropomorphic. They had human emotions and characteristics. Like vanity. Ego. Lust? Yeah, okay. Lust.
I was thinking more of Satan's.
Well, we would say he's the prototype, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to add here, and it's not maybe immediately obvious. It was typical to appeal to the gods, for guidance, I'll put it that way. Before making a major decision, you wanted to consult the oracle somehow or another to get the word on whether you should do this or that. Okay? I think somebody already mentioned there were sacrifices. That's typical. Or offerings. But not necessarily always a sacrifice of a living thing. Maybe one other big one, to see if anybody comes up with it. What was part and parcel of typical polytheistic worship? When you worship the gods, you're also worshiping, yeah, you can say Satan the devil, I don't mean that. What did you worship knowingly? Or what were you appealing to knowingly? Besides just the gods. I'm not explaining it very well. And it's still actually part of several of these religions, including one Christian one. At least one, quote unquote Christian one. Who's up there besides the gods that you can get in contact with?
Angels?
Hmm?
Mediators between the gods, angels?
All right, we would say angels. So I'm looking for something else, though. Who else is up there? I'm saying up there. Out there. That might have a relationship with you. Or a connection to you. That you can appeal to.
Ancestors.
Ancestors. Ancestor worship, maybe that's too strong of a term, but the ancestors were there. They could be appealed to. The idea that human beings have some kind of a soul which goes on beyond life, beyond human life that we know, that's as old as the hills. Old as the hills.
I had a good show on last night. It was up about 3 o'clock in the morning. National Geographic had on Chinese...
Some of them are Buddhist, some of them are Confucius, Taoists.
Buddhist religion. Well, they had there where they took tops of people's skulls and made little troughs and idols, you put a will in, make butter figures on top, and to worship. They chopped up their relatives after they died and put it up on a rock. They call it sky burial, where the birds would come down and pick up the flesh and the bones.
It was like a sacrifice.
Ooh.
After they were dead, they would put them and they would float around and stuff like that. And how they buried their dead and all kinds of stuff.
And their bones, they felt like the bones, just like you believe also the blood has a lot of power spiritually. They believe that the bones and particles of bones did too.
Yeah, and that's still around. That's why.
And that was the purpose of having this altar made out of skull of the head.
Okay.
Bones.
I mean, that's why
one of the reasons why tigers are almost extinct and some elephants are almost extinct, as to that, you know, mankind and certain cultures still worships the power of certain bones. Wow. Okay.
You have it there, but it just reminded me of it. I mean, the sacrifices and offerings, actually human.
Yeah.
burning your own children to their deaths and,
yeah, and some, it wasn't, I don't know that it was part, and maybe somebody knows more, I don't know that it was part of the Mesopotamian religion, but, you know, in our part of the world, in the Americas, it was definitely a part of the worship here. And it was, it's indicated to have been in Canaan as well.
And they worshiped a lot of animals.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have it here. That's one on my list of animals. They're associated with, all right, nature gods represent us to it. Animals. That's another thing they were associated with. They were, now, obviously, they weren't literally worshiping a calf, but they were worshiping a god that was represented by a calf. It was somehow, for some reason or another, he was like a calf, or he was like a fish, or he was like this or that or the other thing. Okay. Anything else before I... We'll come back to all of these, or most of them. Yes. Immoral, non-normative. Mm-hmm. So, what's his face? Gilgamesh. That's an exception to the rule. Because he's not a god, but.
He attains immortality through a series of adventures that he goes through.
Wasn't he, or not him, but back in that time, or Hammurabi's code and that type of thing.
Hammurabi was a Babylonian king who implemented a code.
Yeah. Okay, not okay.
Religions themselves did not promulgate a moral code that was.
Okay, everybody understand that. That's good, a very good point. And I didn't have that in my list. That the Bible is normative, meaning it tells us what to do. Of course, most of these ancient religions didn't have a body of work that claimed to be. This is everything that you need to know about this religion or these gods, but they didn't claim to be normative. And it was the same way, and we've talked about this before, it was the same way in years later in Rome and Greece, you know, where pacifying the gods had nothing at all to do with being moral or immoral. That was a philosophical thing. That wasn't a religious thing. But in the Western thought now, and in Hebrew thought before, the philosophy of being moral was a religious thing. So it's all tied together. So very good point. All right, I don't have it organized perhaps in the best way I would like to, but I've got to, as part of the big picture here, now we've got all these things here, and these characteristics have to do with a typical Mesopotamian god, or perhaps an Egyptian god, or a Canaanite god, or, you know, a god in that part of the world. And we have a book which shows God to be in some ways different than what we have on that list up there. So that's what I want to do now, is explore that a little bit and say, well, why are we even talking about all this stuff? Because we want to see the difference. See the difference. When Abraham was called out, or Abram was called out of a society, and this society, he was an idolater, and he was, or his family was at least, if he wasn't, and they had all this worldview of how things were. What was it that God called him into? What was different? And what was the same? Because not everything was different. What was different? What was the same? So, we've got a few scriptures that I want to share with you. And first of all, as a general principle, actually, maybe I'll ask you. Anthropomorphism in general. That's a broad subject and we can't answer completely. But, put it this way, is God a man? In some ways, he might be like us because he created us in his image. That is a given that we are okay with. But the scripture is clear that God is not a man. Numbers 23:19. You want to write that one down? Isn't that the one that says God's not a man that he would lie? You know, so that's that. He pointed that out. Samuel in 1 Samuel 28. Nope, wrong. That's wrong. 1 Samuel, there's no 1 Samuel. In 1 Samuel 15, verse 29. 1 Samuel 15, verse 29, if I recall correctly, and I won't turn there, but it's Saul. I think it's a discussion between Saul and Samuel. And Samuel says, God's not a man. He's going to change his mind all the time. Now, that doesn't mean God can't change his mind. But the point is, he's not fickle. He's not like a man. God tends to change his mind upon repentance, if you want to put it that way, but not just because you argue with him. Okay. So that's one. There's a couple of scriptures. How about polytheistic? There are many gods. That's the culture that Abram was called out of. The culture that he was called into, how would you describe that culture? Give me a scripture. What does God say about himself? What does God say about himself? All right, go ahead, Tammy.
I don't know where it is, but the Lord our God is one.
Okay, Deuteronomy 6. Yeah, God is one. And Jesus repeated that. The one scribe asked him, he said, what's the most important part of the law or something like that? And Jesus said, the Lord your God is one. Yahweh is one. Okay? Not a whole bunch of guys up there arguing, fighting among themselves. So he's one. And that was Mark, you can write down Mark 12. Verse 28, Deuteronomy 6, 4. So, in a sense, I think it's fair to say, we got people here that will argue with this if I'm wrong. In a sense, this book is a, now the words slip my mind, it's a polemic. In the face of all this, all these religions that say God is many, God is like human beings, fighting or arguing, or whatever. This book is grinding an axe, as we say in our modern terminology. This book is saying, no, our God is not like that. In fact, to go one step further, our God is the God. He made all your gods, if you're worshiping the sun, the moon, stars, and the earth, and the animals, which is another message from the creation history we have in Genesis. Say, whatever it is you worship, our God made it. Nah, 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 nah. No, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's kind of that way. Anything your God can do, my God can do better because my God made your God. I mean, that's the message. That's the behind-the-scenes message there. Maybe not so behind-the-scenes. When you read, like I read, and you could... You know, all day long you get these stories from some of these ancient religions. And you read about the conflict, and you read about the sex, and you read about the human emotion, the lust, the vanity, the ego, and on and on and on. This God kills that God, cut that in half, and, you know, and they can't sleep because it's too noisy, and, you know, whatever. You read all that stuff. It might be a way of saying, here's how things came to be. Yeah, I'll give it that. But what is that a story of? What's the story about? Now, this is more of the stepping back to get a big picture. What is this story about when you read about these gods? Now, that's not a hard question. It's just a step to get you somewhere else. What's the story about? Is it a story about the people in the towns? Is it a story about their history? Or is it a story about these gods?
I don't know if this is where you're going, but what comes to my mind is there's a battle between Satan and God for worship. Maybe I'm taking.
Okay, well, you're going beyond where I was simpler than that yet. To me, and I'm not an expert on all these things, to me, all this stuff, all you read, the stories are about the gods and what they're doing and what they want. It's about them. It's all about them. Yeah, right?
It was a soap opera
over time. Okay, the soap opera. It kind of comes across that way. What is this a book about? Step back. I mean, sometimes we get involved in all the details. But get way away from this. What is this a book about? There's a lot of right answers to that. Somebody be brave enough to say some things. Purpose, relationship, okay. I think that's good. Now, let's flesh this out a little bit. You.
It's all about God's plan for man.
That's all about God's plan for man, okay.
When you were talking about the other gods, I always thought they were early humans, that the stories were kept being retold and then they were made into gods.
Okay, she's making the point that some of the myths could refer to early great humans, that their stories lived on. That could be. I can't prove that one way or the other. I think in some cases you're probably right. But I don't.
The Bible is about righteous living versus the polytheistic gods are unrighteous.
Okay. About a different way of life. I think these are all combined together. And I agree with all the answers. And this is, I'll put it together in my own words. Whereas these are stories about the gods, or even maybe about some ancient humans that had great, in some cases, had great legends associated with them. It was about them. This book, amazingly enough, is about us. It really is. That's about God, but it's about God in the perspective of what he's doing with us. It's telling us, telling the world, anybody who wants to read it, what happened, and that's not the purpose of this sermon, but what happened? You got 11 chapters in Genesis that cover 2,600 years or something like that. That gives some very basic little details, not much, about what happened and why the world's so messed up. Then you got the whole rest of the book. All right, if I can turn to Genesis 11, that's right here. From here all the way through the rest of the book, it's about what God's doing to fix that. And it involves you and me. It's a story about his creation and how he is fixing it and how he's going about righting the world.
Can I just say?
Yeah, please.
It's not just about us. It's about all human beings.
Oh, when I said us, I didn't mean those of us in the room. I meant humans.
Well, but I just wanted to expand on
that. Okay. Yes. Exactly. And I will submit that that's different. Different than what you read in the other accounts. Now, again, granted, these other ancient religions don't have one single book that, explains their whole philosophy, but that's a good way of summarizing it. Thank you. Yes?
Isn't it interesting that man has to have a God? In other words, if these gods even ever came into being, why did they conjure these up if at some time before that, somebody did understand that there was a greater power?
That's a good point. The anthropologists have their answers for that, and they have their answers for how they determine some of the things that we're talking about. That, well, when people bury their dead in a certain way, it indicates they had an idea that you were going to live beyond death, and those kinds of things. But they're guesses. But yeah, why is it man has a need for something greater than himself? Is that I would agree with you that it's put into us. That we're made in his image. It means just like he has a desire to the work of his hands, I think Job says that, we have a desire to the one who made us. The clay has an affinity for the potter. So it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing story. And it's not just about what's going on in heaven. It's about the plan that's being directed from heaven that has to do with the earth. And that's different. And we'll find, not just in this sermon, but in the next sermon as well, we'll find that that's very different. Very different in some ways. Now, again, there's just, Actually, with Hindu and Buddhism, you'll find that they do have their ideas about the way the world, where you should live in the world, but they're almost more philosophical ideas than religious ideas. Okay, let's see. What else I want to cover before I get some scriptures here? The story of the Bible is man's story. It's the story of salvation. How is it accomplished? How is it being directed? Like the way that Rick put it. The God that is the subject of this book is not limited. Now, what evidence do we have for that? Even from the book itself. God called Abram from Ur of the Chaldees and told him to go down to Canaan. For most gods, that would be a non sequitur. Make sense? For the God of Babylon to tell you to go to Canaan would make no sense at all, because that God doesn't have anything to do with Canaan. Why would he want you to go from here to here and still be your God? Doesn't work that way. Baal was not asking people, personalizing this or making it happen, but Baal wasn't asking people to leave Canaan and go to, southern Africa, because he wasn't God there. But the God of the Bible has the nerve, if you want to put it that way, to ask somebody who's living over here to come down here and still worship the same God. It's different. That's what I want to, that's the purpose of this sermon. The point of how different this book is than all the stuff we wrote up on the board. It's very different when you step back from it and look at it. That this God would say, I want you to, I want to call my people out of Egypt. Egypt's got plenty of gods. Now what did they say? The one guy said there's 2,400 of them up there where Abraham is. 2,000 gods, but I want you to work, you're going to worship me, not all them, and you'll worship me down here. And he told the Israelites the same thing. Took them out of a place where there were hundreds of gods and said, I want you to come up here and worship me. I'm your God here, I'm your God here, I'm your God everywhere. We take that for granted in the Western Christian world, don't we? But it was very different when this book was written. When Moses was walking the earth, when the other people that wrote this book were walking the earth, those ideas were radical. Very different. And I'm just trying to bring them alive a little bit today so we don't take it for granted. The God is, one thing about polytheism, and when you study Rome, you get this, and if you study the other cultures, many times a polytheistic society has no problem at all with your religion. Why? You can worship who you want. We've got 100. You got one, that's fine. We've got 10, it's fine. You got 100, that's fine. We don't care. There's all kinds of gods. You're going to have different ones than I have. That's okay. A polytheistic society doesn't have a problem with being exclusive. They understand there's all kinds of gods and everybody's going to worship whoever they want. The one that's the star of this book says, I'm the only one. And I'm going to read, I'm going to turn to Daniel chapter 4. So when you read some of these accounts of things that happened, and you get that in your mind, you realize how different this God of the Hebrews was, this Yahweh, how different he was. It's again, I think it sometimes helps to just lose yourself a little bit and into this world and realize how different the God that you worship is from what was typical in that day. Daniel chapter 4. Now this is the account of Nebuchadnezzar becoming insane, right? And then he gets his wits back about him. And verse 34 says, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. So he gets his senses back, right? And he blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion and his kingdom from generation to generation. Now, why is it written like that? Because, hey, this guy's in charge. This one, we got a lot of gods here, but we don't have any like this one. He's describing something different. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he does according to his will in the army of heaven. Whoa, did you catch that? I'm reading King James. If you got a better translation, tell me. But it's saying, he does what he wants up there. It's not like our stories where they're all fighting each other. They might get the way, they might not. If you get enough on your side, you can be the top for a little while. And if you get enough allies, you can be in charge, but not forever because things are going to change. It's not like that. This God says, and Nebuchadnezzar in this account is saying this. He says he does what he wants. He's not limited or local or tied in with nature or representable or immoral or non-normal. He's none of that. It's very different. See if I think it's all I wanted to read there. Yeah, I said, none can stop him, stay his hand. We're saying, what are you doing? Here's a God that nobody can just say, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing? Now, what is not being said there is what you all discussed already, is that in these other stories, there's always somebody off to the side saying, what are you doing? What are you doing it that way for? We're going to do it this way. Not with this God. It's different. It's qualitatively different. And that's the point I want to make very clear. I know I keep saying it, but I want you to transport yourself into a different culture and a different society. Let's look at this list that we've got up on the board, and let's get some scriptures here. First Kings chapter 18. I don't even remember what this verse is. Sorry. First Kings chapter 18. And verse 26. Oh, it's Elijah. That's right. Okay. Now, we said that the gods of Babylon, the gods of Egypt, whatever, they're anthropomorphic. They're like human beings, right? That's not something you all just dreamed up. I think you got it right. And you weren't the first one to come up with it, because if let's look at 1 Kings 18, verse 26. And you know the story, right? Elijah calls all the prophets of Baal, gets them together, set the sacrifice up, and they're supposed to call down fire from heaven. And what does Elijah do? For people, I tend to be a little bit sarcastic, and we had a discussion when I was in Thailand with one of the teachers, and she likes sarcasm a little bit, but she had a professor in her Bible school who told her that sarcasm is always bad. And I said, well, Elijah did it, and that's one example anyway. It doesn't pass judgment on whether it was right or wrong, but he did it. So it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, better cry louder. He's talking, he's running after somebody, or he's on a trip, or maybe he's asleep and needs to be awakened. Elijah's saying, your God is like a human being. And of course, my God isn't. And that's the point. And Elijah, many years ago, and whoever assembled the books of the Kings put that in here as a classic example of what's different about Yahweh. One of the things that's different. He's not like human beings in that same sense. I mean, again, he has a relationship with us, so in that sense he is, and we understand that. In 2 Chronicles, chapter 28, I've been in my regular Bible reading, I'm in Kings and Chronicles, and I've discovered all kinds of things, some of which I didn't notice that were there before. But I got a few verses from Chronicles and Kings. 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 22. This is talking about Ahaz, if I got it right. Yeah, and he was under pressure from the king of Assyria. In verse 23, it says, he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus. So again, the writers of the Bible are very clear on the fact that other cultures had many gods. All right? He sacrificed to the gods of Damascus. So they understood that. If we go to chapter 33 and verse 3, it's talking here about Manasseh, who was a bad king, at least at the beginning of his reign. And he built the high places that Hezekiah, his father, had broken down, and he reared up altars for Baalim. And if you have the New American Standard, it says Baals. Right? So what's that tell you? Baalim is the same, it's English, but it's imitating the Hebrew there for a plural. In other words, there's more than one Baal. That's just the way it was. Now, maybe they understood a high up Baal or some kind of a hierarchy. I don't know. But when we read, I just want to turn to a few verses. You can write these down. You don't need to turn to them all. But to lend support to the idea that these gods were limited and local, okay? You want to write these down. I got Numbers 25, verse 3. I didn't mark. I got to find them. Numbers 25, verse 3 says, it's just referring to a city here. Israel joined himself on the Baal Peor. All right, that's one Baal. We got Baal Peor. They would name cities after the gods because they were local or areas. All right, in Numbers 32 and verse 38, Nebo and Baal Meon, another city named after Baal. Okay, that local Baal. Judges 3:3. And we can just keep looking at these. You can write down Judges 3:3, 2 Samuel 13:23. I don't need to turn there, but it's the same thing where you got different cities and their local Baal. And it was just named after them. Now, that's a common, you see that in the Greek, you see it in Greece, you see it in Rome all the time. They named cities after their gods, they named cities after their Caesars, and after people, you know, famous people. That's, and we still do that. Local. Now, here's these to me are interesting. I got some scriptures. I'll just give them to you. As far as gods being associated with animals, you can write down 1 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 3. That's when the ark, when the Philistines got the ark and they put it in the temple there with Dagon, which is their fish god. That word Dag in Hebrew meaning fish. And the idol fell over every night, right? So they finally sent the ark back. So there you got a fish god. You can write down Exodus 32, verses 1 to 4, where Israel wanted to worship a calf. And Hughes talked to us in sermons before about the Apis bull and how Egypt venerated this bull. So the fact that these gods were associated with animals is well known, and it's there in Scripture as well. A couple other things before I turn to some Scriptures. As far as appealing to God for immediate needs, that's not wrong. Jesus said, give us, you know, in the model prayer, give us this day our daily bread. That's okay. So, and, you know, there are certain characteristics of society that this is my opinion, you can take it or leave it, that God decided to work with. You know, when people in the ancient world would go to their local oracle and say, should I go up to war? Should I plant today or tomorrow or whatever? That's something that has its origin in pre-biblical times or pre-Israel times, whatever. But then you come to the time of Israel and you had your priests and you had your Urim and the Thummim and you had ways that and you can write down some scriptures that I'll give you. They had ways that kings could say, should I go up to battle or not? And they asked. So is that God's idea that he's going to do it that way, or was God just saying, this is what people do anyway? And they want to come to me instead of going to a pagan god, so he accommodates them. I don't know the answer to that. But the point is, there was a way for the king to reach out to God via the priests and get an answer for what they were supposed to do. In fact, an interesting story. Where is that? 2 Chronicles 18. 2 Chronicles 18. This is a fun one. Like I told you, I've been reading through Kings and Chronicles. Now, this was a time when the king of Judah was kind of warned, don't ally yourself with the king of Israel. It's not a good idea, but he did it anyway. And Jehoshaphat, I believe, yeah, he was the king of Judah. And he was going to ally himself with Ahab, which is a bad idea from the get-go with Ahab. But just to be allied with Israel was a bad idea. And they wanted to go out and fight to Ramoth-Gilead. And fight against somebody. And Jehoshaphat, being the more God-fearing king from the kingdom of Judah, says, well, I'm with you. We're brothers. You know, your fight, your battle's my battle, but can't we go to God and find out what he has to say about this? And so Ahab brings all these Baal priests out. Oh, yeah. We go up, and God's going to give it to you. One guy's got horns on showing he's going to be powerful and you're going to win. And you got all this stuff. And they're used to giving the king what he wants to hear. And Jehoshaphat says, well, don't you have a prophet for Yahweh? Aren't there any of them up here?
And Ahab says, well, yeah, there's this one guy. Don't get the story right. He says, there's this one guy, but he always tells me something I don't want to hear. I don't like him. I hate him. I hate his guts. That's what it says. It doesn't say guts. It says, I hate him. Well, can't. Well, why don't you bring him here? And so the guy comes, and again, here's another sarcasm. He says, go up. God will give you the victory. Yeah. And Ahab knows he's bluffing him. Ahab says, no. How many times I got to tell you? Tell me what God said. Don't just do that. He says, okay, well, what I see. And he starts describing a scene of destruction and how bad it's going to be. And Ahab says, I'll deal with you when I come back. And the prophet says, yeah, if you come back, then God's not talking through me. And Ahab didn't make it back. So it's a fun story in a way. I mean, it's sad. You know, it's sad because Jehoshaphat didn't listen and all this type of thing. But the point is that even a king who wasn't following Yahweh would be accustomed to reaching out to some oracle for a decision. And so God accommodated that custom, if you want to put it that way, or that habit, and it made it possible to go to the high priest and get some kind of a judgment or understanding. Okay, I got to speed up here. You think I'm going fast enough already. I want to turn to a couple of verses because I promised you something maybe you haven't seen before. 1 Kings chapter 20 and verse 23. Let's talk about God's being local. Just a little bit. I'll just show you some verses you probably have seen before and understood this. In 1 Kings 20 and verse 23. All right, here we got a battle, and I'm not going to give you the details. I don't remember all the details myself, but they're fighting with the Syrians. And in verse 23 of 1 Kings 20, it says, the servants of the king of Syria said to their king, their gods are the gods of the hills, therefore they are stronger than we are, but let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we will be stronger than they. What's their reasoning? Well, Israel, especially down in the Judean highlands and all that, and up in the northern kingdom too, they got all these hills. And the Syrians, they've got the flatter terrain. Says, our gods are the gods of the flat places, the plains, the valleys. Their gods are the gods of the hills. We don't want to fight them in the hills because they're going to have success there. It's just like I was telling you in Thailand. If you want to have success in Chiang Mai district, you got to go up on that temple. And you can see the temple from the whole city of Chiang Mai. It's way up on a mountain. In fact, the first time I ever went up to that temple, I couldn't see the city because it was winter. Everybody burns leaves and stuff to stay warm. And it's not really cold by our standards, but for theirs it is. And it was so much smog, I couldn't see the city. It's way up high. When I go over there, this spring, I'll be able, at nighttime, you see this all lit up, this temple. It's got the high spot. The high, Hezekiah took down all the high places, That, Chiang Mai, that's up there on a high place. You got a whole city, and it's a big city. Chiang Mai's a big city. Over a million people. The whole city can see this temple up there. Well, the Syrian people, they understood this concept that the gods are local. That's what they thought. And you know what? They're right. To get back to some of you who are saying this is about Satan. Satan's got a whole hierarchy, doesn't he? Of demons. And they have control over the world because they are the one, he's the king of the world right now. So I believe, now I'm getting off the subject here a little bit, but I believe that there's some truth to this. There is a local king. A local, representative of the supernatural that rules from this temple. And if that's the system you're going to be part of, then you better bow down to it. We're called out of that. Abraham was called out of that. Something very different. Okay, a couple more verses. 2 Kings 17. 2 Kings 17, verse 22. I didn't write down the context of these, so I got to look at each one and figure out what it was. I was talking about 17. Do I have the right verse? That the the children of Israel are following Jeroboam. They're worshiping gods, of course. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, and it gives these cities, and they put them in the cities of Samaria. And remember, and I won't go into the rest of it, but isn't this where the lions came, and they had problems. Yeah. So I don't want to take the time to read it, but I'll just explain it a little bit. They had. They had trouble with the land, and the Assyrians said, oh, you know what? We don't know how to worship the God of the land here, and he's mad, so that's why we're dying. We need to have one of their priests show us what we're supposed to do.
So they appointed somebody a priest, and he, you know, explained to everybody what they're supposed to do and how to worship God. And you notice here it says, when you get down to verse 33, it says they feared the Lord. They feared Yahweh and served their own gods. So they called it Yahweh worship, whatever the, you know, the Hebrew term was for that. But they were worshiping all their own gods. So they're doing, you know, they're worshiping in vain, following the wrong commands and so forth. But you see here, here's the concept again. That this invading force came and said, we don't understand the way the gods of the land work here. They got local gods. Our local gods don't work down here. We need to understand how their local gods work. All right, so this is just some biblical evidence for what we've already been talking about, how it was. One more before I turn to the one that really surprised me. 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Chronicles 32, verse 11. This is when, you know, the Sennacherib came against Jerusalem, and they, you know, he's yelling at them all on the wall, and all that was going on, and it was an overwhelming army there. And Sennacherib, or, you know, whoever's talking for him in the language of that the Jews could understand there, he says, doesn't Hezekiah persuade you to give over yourselves to die by famine and thirst, saying the Lord our God will deliver us? And isn't this the same Hezekiah that took away the high places? So, you know, from their pagan perspective, in Assyria, he's saying, how can Hezekiah be telling you that God's going to save you? He's the one that tore down his high places. He didn't understand that those high places weren't Yahweh's high places. To him, it looked like this is the king who's against the God. Right? So it didn't make any sense to him. Did I have another verse here? Maybe down to verse 19. They spoke against the God of Jerusalem as against the gods of the people of the earth. So he's making that connection. Like, the God of Jerusalem is just like the gods of, you know, we have gods in our towns too. So what? Yours isn't going to save you. In fact, your king even took down the high places. So that was their mindset. That was their culture. Jerusalem had a God. Hebron had a God. Everybody's got a God. That was the idea. Now, here's the one that surprised me. 2 Kings 5. Maybe some of you know the answer. Maybe I'm wrong, but if I'm right, maybe somebody knows it and they can share it before I give the punchline here. In 2 Kings 5, it's a story of Naaman. You know, remember he came and he was a leper, and he came to, was it Elisha? And he wanted to be healed. Elisha said, go dip into Jordan. And then he has an attitude because he said, well, can't we go up and dip in our own rivers? Then one of his men had enough sense to say, look, if he had made you do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? Well, he asked you to do something simple. Why don't you do it? Anyway, he's healed, right? And he wants to give a gift. And Elisha says, no, I don't want the gift. I don't need a gift. And I'm really summarizing this. Verse 16 says, as the Lord lives, as Yahweh lives before whom I stand, I will receive none. I'm not going to take your gift. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And of course, the story goes on to say how the servant, Gehazi, or whatever his name was, you know, kind of wanted the gift and lusted after it. But we're not going to get to that. Look at verse 17. Naaman said, shall there not then, I pray you, be given to your servant 2 mules, burden of earth? Why was he asking for a couple of carts of dirt? You can keep reading on. There's hints there. All the years I've ever read this, I never got it. I think I got it now. Not because I'm so smart, but I read it somewhere when I was studying it. Why did he want a couple of cartloads of dirt? Anybody got an idea? It has to do with that right there. What? It says he wants to build an altar. But this God that healed him of leprosy is the God of this area. And if he's going to build an altar, he needs some dirt from here. My dirt ain't going to work from back home. Isn't that? I'm not brilliant here. I just read that somewhere and said, oh, that makes sense. Because at the time I was thinking about the sermon. He needed some local stuff to make the altar from. Because in his mind,
All gods are local. What's the expression in America? Anybody from Chicago? All politics is local, right? All gods are local to everybody else in the world except Christians. And now, you know, Jews and Muslims and a few others. Gods are local. Anyway, that's the one. That was my guarantee of something that you probably hadn't thought of before. All right, so you get your money back if you already knew that. Okay. Well, I need to wrap up. It's already too late. I was going to tie it in with Abraham, and because I just want to make the point. Again, in the big picture, Yahweh's different. He's a different kind of God. He called Abraham out of all that into a different set of beliefs, a belief that this God is universal. He's, you know, Yahweh is God. He's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He's different than any of these gods that you have experience with or that you think you know. We got a book that gives us a story, not of the gods, but of the men who are being saved by the God. And it's a whole history of salvation, going from the beginning, as Rick put, you know, beginning to the end in the garden, and righting the world. The world got turned upside down. It's going to be turned back right again. And we'll get into more about, you know, the end game and what these people are looking for in other religions. It's not clear what the people in ancient times were thinking about beyond the grave because they didn't always write it down. The Egyptians were clear that they thought there was an afterlife. They did believe in an immortal soul, and they had very extensive funerary rituals to try to get you prepared and ready for what was coming afterwards and so forth. And they didn't apparently believe in the you can't take it with you idea because they buried themselves with all the stuff so they could take with. And so they believed in something beyond. What they believed in, I don't know. Exactly, I haven't studied into that. Many of the ancient religions who did have a belief in the afterlife just believed everybody went to the same place. It wasn't this heaven-hell dichotomy. It was just a place for the dead. A place for the dead. And that's where you could get in touch with your ancestors and so forth. So this story is really, how can I put this in a couple of minutes? It's a story, really, beginning in Genesis chapter 12, about one man and his descendants. I think I can accurately say that. It's about one man and his descendants, some of which, especially in the Old Testament, are his physical, literal descendants, and some of which include all of us, are his spiritual descendants. The process of salvation that this book talks about begins in Genesis 12 with Abram. And everybody, according to this book, all the evidence we're given, everybody who's saved is saved after a fashion or after a manner similar to Abraham. The Jews got it, just one side of it, that all you have to do is be descended from him or get grafted in by circumcision or something like that. In the New Testament, we get the rest of the story, which is no. Abraham was saved by faith before the law, so the salvation is open to everybody. Everybody. No matter what people of the earth they are. No matter what part of that that pie diagram they are. And I could have talked a lot more about that, but the book, to begin this process of looking toward Passover, the book is about the process of salvation. Passover is the first holy day, or the first observance that we have during the year, the first festival, not Sabbath. Points to the beginning of that process, that God accepts you, and that God accepts me because he accepts his son's sacrifice. And then we become part of that group that this whole book's about, the children of Abraham. And thus we are in the salvation group, the people that are going to be saved, the people of God, N.T. Wright likes to call them, the people of God. It's not just Israel. It's everybody who's after the similitude, if you want to use that term, of Abraham. So Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is set about making the world right, turning it right side up again. It's a long process. He sent his son to make it possible. The world will be made right, and we're part of the plan. We're part of this book. We're part of the story. It's not just about something way off in Never Never Land in past history. We're part of the story. And that's what makes this book so imminent, so close to us, so near to us. It's not about some them off in heaven who have their issues with each other and use human beings to satisfy their lusts and their needs. It's about us
man, who, thanks to the Son of Man, are destined to be a part of God's restored world. And how great is that?